vertically challenged, so move that down a little. Thank you for the introduction, Tanya, and thanks everybody for joining. I'm very excited to hear my co-presenters, actually, so I want to hurry up and finish so I can listen to them. I'm excited to be here. I'm excited to share with you the NIAID's research response to Ebola. But one thing I want to know before getting started is about you a little bit. So who here is involved in clinical research? Anybody do clinical research for your profession? Okay, a couple. And how about working in international settings in general? I got a double winner over here. That's great. That's great. So I hope this is informative for all of you, and we'll work through that. So now that I know a little bit about you, looking for the advance. There we go. Okay. So what I want to do first is present a little bit of background on Ebola. How many are familiar with Ebola as a disease? Somewhat familiar? Okay, great. We've all seen it in the news, unfortunately. Sometimes a little bit too dramatic for my liking, but that's the way the media goes sometimes. And I want to describe a little bit about how the evolution of the outbreak, just to give a little bit of background, and then go into, as I said, the NIAID clinical research response and discuss general research issues and those pertaining directly to gender. We are doing a natural history study on Ebola, and a lot of those data are just now being collated. So some of that I cannot share at this time, but I'll share what I can. So Ebola virus disease is a hemorrhagic fever, and it's caused by infection with the Fila virus. It is a zoonotic infection, which means an index case transferred from an animal to a human. The index case was thought to be an 18-month-old child in Guinea. And again, he was thought to be playing with bats or around bats, though this is not completely confirmed. This is what they are thinking right now is the best case of what might have happened. This child died in December of 2013, and we'll keep that in mind as we go through the presentation, and I'll talk to you about some timelines that are relevant to that date. How is it spread? It's spread through fluids in the body, such as those up on the slide, and it is extremely infectious, as we know. This slide outlines a timeline. Again, if we remember, the index case died in December of 2013. As you see, the first yellow down here outline slide, the WHO actually reported an outbreak of EVD or Ebola virus disease in March of 2014. So 3 months passed from the time that the child died to the first report of an outbreak in Guinea. And the next yellow piece that you will see up here, the WHO declared Ebola a public health emergency in August of 2014. So you can see lots of things happened in between that time, but that was 8 months later. That was 8 months after the child died. We lost a lot of time. We lost a lot of time to research Ebola. We lost a lot of time to respond to the people that were being affected by Ebola. And I have to say that this was a myriad of issues, and we were all responsible. Government was responsible, NGOs, private industry, we were all responsible for this lag. And I think we've learned a lot from it, and that we need to go forward knowing this in our minds for the next outbreak that might occur, that we handle it much differently in the future. This shows you the epidemic curve for Ebola. Sierra Leone has the most cases, with Liberia and Guinea following after that. Liberia actually has the most cases per population, over 28,000 cases. I'll go into now the collaborative USG response carried out by the NIAID Division of Clinical Research. So clinical research, in a simplest form, is any human study that involves an informed consent. So something that we talk about with the participant, what they will be taking on, what the benefit will be, what the risks will be, anything within informed consent. So it allows us, if we're doing clinical research in this setting, it allows us to do real-time characterization of the disease process. It allows us to enhance clinical management practice and reduce mortality. It allows us to assess the efficacy and safety of potential treatments for Ebola and potential vaccines and prevention measures. And And importantly, it allows us to be able to take that information that we've learned while studying it and use it after products have been licensed. So what's the take-home from this slide? The take-home is if we embed clinical research in the outbreak response, we can contribute to saving lives right away and shorten and end, potentially end, infectious disease outbreaks. So what keeps us up at night at the Division of Clinical Research? There's a troubling reality here. As of October 26, 28,000 cases, over 11,000 deaths. Research has not yet demonstrated a safe and effective Ebola therapy. So here we are, over a year later, with no treatment that has been given as an effective therapy. There have been lots of clinical trials, lots ongoing, including the one that we have, but there hasn't been anything that's definitive as of yet. That's troubling. We have potential vaccine efficacy on several studies that have been done in the West African region, but we have nothing yet that is confirmed. And this is because we started late. If we had started at the time when Ebola was at its peak, we would have had enough participants to be able to do a proper and appropriate randomized clinical trial, which would show us how many people we would need. There are certain, the statisticians will tell you in a clinical research study, you need a certain number of people that come down with Ebola that are on the vaccine or on the control arm to be able to understand. We didn't have that number. All we can show now is immunogenicity of the vaccines rather than effectiveness. There are no licensed products yet for Ebola. We need to seize upon these learning opportunities presented in outbreak responses. So when were we able to start our research? In August of 2014, this is when the Secretary of Health and Human Services and the Liberian Ministry of Health began their conversations. In October of 2014, nearly 10 months after this child died in Guinea, is when Secretary Burwell accepted the invitation and indicated NIAID and my boss, Dr. Cliff Lane, to lead the response. At that time, the WHO endorsed a phase 2/3 vaccine study, which means safety and efficacy, in Liberia, and our team met in Liberia for the first time at the end of October. I have since been to Liberia and Guinea. I have not yet been to Sierra Leone 13 times in 1 year. So we've done a great deal of collaboration, and it has been an incredibly rewarding program. So besides the practical aspects of setting up clinical research, one has to consider many of these elements of research collaboration. Not only consider, but implement them. So these things take time, right? We're talking about trust, mutual respect, partnership, synergistic goals. We have to understand what our partner wants. Our partner in this case being Liberia, the Ministry of Health, the government in Liberia. This foundation of trust takes time, but it's critical. So again, I go back to the fact it's got to be embedded in the initial response because you have to start this right away to be able to do really robust clinical research. And I can tell you, I have never had a better research partner than we've had with Liberia. It's been an amazing, amazing partnership. This slide shows the outline of the activities that we have been doing since October of 2014 in Liberia and also in Sierra Leone and Guinea. We have our headquarters in Liberia, so you'll hear me talk a lot about Liberia, as we're much more connected in that country than the other two, though we do work in all three. Again, we signed the MOU in October of 2014. In January of 2015, we started to enroll participants on a vaccine study. I'll describe more about that in a moment. We received all of the FDA approvals, which were expedited in this case by the FDA. And then in March of 2015, we began our treatment study, which is now studying the drug ZMapp, which many of you probably heard about in the news as well. And we completed our phase two, vaccine study enrollment just before April. And we began a natural history study in June. So that's a lot of clinical research to be done in 12 months. It typically does not happen that way. It's a new paradigm for us, and we're very excited to try this. And in fact, within the Division of Clinical Research, we are advocating for and will likely receive an office that will just be prepared to do emergency response. Along with the studies, we have also been doing capacity building in all of these hospitals and clinics in Liberia and Guinea, Sierra Leone. We have done renovations there. We've done training and education. We have set up all of the clinics for long term. So our minimum commitment is 5 years. So after Ebola is over, we're not just going to go in, study Ebola, and then say, okay, you know, we're done. You know, nice to know you. We've made a 5-year commitment, and I think that has meant a lot to our partners. So the title of our partnership is the Partnership for Research on Ebola Virus in Liberia. As you know, as I said, we've worked in the other countries as well, but mainly Liberia. And for short, we call it PREVAIL, which was very time in October 2014. It was really nice to think, you know, we're going to prevail over this Ebola. It was scary for the people. It was scary for the U.S. at that time. You know, it was right around the time that the Dallas cases were showing up, and we had a lot of work to do. You'll see the top picture has the U.S. ambassador to Liberia, Ms. Deborah Malik, is in the blue dress, and next to her is the Surgeon General Vivek Murthy. And we were on a tour of our clinic at JFK Memorial Hospital in Liberia at the time. In the bottom left, you see where the vaccine is prepped, and we do that on the embassy grounds, actually. And on the bottom right, that's a picture of training of participant tractors in Sierra Leone. The vaccine study. Our principal investigators are Dr. Stephen Kennedy and Dr. Cliff Lane, who's my boss. On all of our studies, we have a Liberian PI and a U.S. PI. Primary objectives of the vaccine study are to determine the efficacy of the CHAD3 vaccine compared with placebo and the VSV vaccine as compared with placebo. CHAD3 is manufactured by GSK, and VSV is manufactured now by Merck. So what's the enrollment summary for this vaccine study? We have enrolled 1,500 participants to date. Their average age is about 33. We have 36.6% females. So I'll stop here and tell a little story. At Redemption Hospital, it's a free hospital in Liberia where we first started the vaccine study, we were getting only men. The only people that were volunteering were men. And the days went by and I thought, well, this might change, but it didn't. So I went outside and the men were lined up to come into the study, and I just gathered them around. I'm like, hey guys, can you tell me, where are the women? And, you know, they kind of puffed out their chests and they said, you know, we're the strong men of Liberia and the women will follow when we say it's okay. So I thought that very interesting, and it really speaks to all of the social mobilization efforts that needed to be done in this collaboration as well. A lot of communication in West Africa happens by word of mouth. That's good and that's bad. So sometimes that can lead to rumors that aren't true. A lot of people in these countries believe that the vaccine causes Ebola, so the men were there to make sure that everything was okay for the women. We actually had to halt enrollment to the men and only recruit women so that the DSMB would be comfortable with the percentage of women on the study. And I'm sorry, DSMB is a data safety monitoring board that looks at, anytime you have a randomized study, a blinded study, they look at the safety data and make sure everything that's going on is okay. So they wanted to see more women. We saw HIV positive about 5% and syphilis positive about 5%. Interestingly enough, the country itself feels that their HIV rate is lower than 5%. I have a guess that it's likely 5% or higher because of the poor health infrastructure and the inability to test. There is an almost 99% follow-up visit rate, which means the people are coming back in to do their follow-up visits at a 99% rate. Unbelievably good. This really speaks to the social mobilization efforts, the participant tracking, and the dedication, and really it's amazing competence of our Liberian colleagues. We have been so incredibly impressed. The PREVAIL 2 is our treatment study, which is now studying ZMAP, and that the co-PIs there are Dr. Moses Masakoi and Richard Davey from the National Institutes of Health. Upper left-hand corner, the gentleman right here is Dr. Jerry Brown, who many of you may recognize from the Time Magazine Man of the Year. He is also one of our investigators on the treatment study, and some of the PHS officers are also noted there. They were also a partner in this study. You'll see an ETU, Emergency Treatment Unit, up in the right-hand corner in Sierra Leone, and our team in Sierra Leone on the bottom. So this study is meant to study new candidate therapies for Ebola and to enhance the standard of care. The primary objective, obviously, is to establish safety and efficacy of investigational treatments. So to date, we have enrolled 70 participants on this study, majority in Sierra Leone, obviously, and then 12 in Guinea and 4 in the Liberia and U.S. The statisticians believe that we will have answers to the efficacy for this study, somewhere between 60 and 100 participants. So we're getting close. The DSMB, again, will signal if at a time that they realize that this is effective or it is not going to be effective. Either way, they will tell us, and we will do the proper things as far as either closing the study or different modifications that one may do to the study at that time. PREVAIL 3, it's a natural history study. It's the principal investigators, Dr. Masoka Fala and Michael Snaller, also from the NIH. You'll see down in the bottom left-hand corner, there's Dr. Fala. These pictures are taken at JFK Hospital where we renovated, and you can see some of our eye equipment that we took over there. And I just wanted to mention, we're taking a lot of equipment and supplies that we will leave with the Liberians when we're gone. So there are approximately 1,500 registered Ebola survivors in Liberia. We know there are likely thousands more. It's just that those are the ones the Ministry of Health has registered. All of these reports have been taken in terms of conditions and after effects of Ebola. We'll touch on some of these. We will plan to enroll at least 1,500 survivors and up to 6,000 close contacts of those survivors. We want to analyze the clinical manifestations seen in EVD patients as well as the viral persistence. So what is the viral persistence? That means how long is the virus staying in the body after recovery? So this has become a critical issue if some of you are following the news on these issues. We are seeing that Ebola is being passed through sexual transmission. It is rare, but it is happening. And there's a case in the UK that some of you may have read about. It's a Scottish nurse that has had a recurrence of Ebola. And she has had the recurrence happen in her spinal fluid. So Ebola can nest itself in what's called immune-privileged reservoirs and come out in things such as the spinal fluid, which we did not know until the Scottish nurse. Again, the need for doing research real-time, in an outbreak response, has to happen. So she has spinal meningitis. She had lots of central nervous system issues. Luckily, she's doing well, but for a while, it looked like she was not going to make it, even though she survived the first Ebola recovery. She is doing better now, but we need to understand that. So what we're going to do now in our study, we're already poised to do this because we have the study open, is that we're going to do lumbar punctures, which means we'll be able to collect spinal fluid. We'll be able to test the spinal fluid. We'll be able to understand its viral persistence and look to ways to be able to, perhaps you'd want to use a drug like ZMapp in the future, target those specific areas. Or maybe there's another compound that would work better for that particular reservoir. These are the types of things we need to know. Some components of our study involve an ophthalmologic part of our study, so looking at the eyes, a neonatal, which I'm really interested in listening to Dr. Johnson's presentation on that. And then, again, as I mentioned, fluid collection and a neurologic component. So the spinal fluid. So one of the things we want to test with regard to the spinal fluid, we want to do MRIs and we want to do CT scans so we can understand more about the neurologic symptoms that these patients are having. So we are purchasing and sending over MRI and CT scanner, which they have none of these in the country, if you can imagine, not a single one. So again, those will be left there for the Liberians to use for as long as they wish. So the current status of enrollment, we have 992 survivors on study right now in three sites in Liberia. We have 182 contacts. We started with our survivors, and now we are enrolling contacts and starting to collect data from both of them. So now move into talking about some of the general research issues and those related to gender. I wish I had more on gender. I actually had a few slides that I had to take out because they weren't ready for presentation yet. But we're really close to providing some, and I know it'll be in the literature soon. Of 749 survivors, preliminary analysis, 55% were women. So we didn't have the same issue that we had in the vaccine study. These women came out. They had these issues and conditions. They wanted to find some answers. I remember talking to the first crew that came in to the JFK hospital. We sat and we had a conversation. I said, why are you here individually? What do you want to learn? What is it that is troubling you? And each one, I have to give so much credit, I'm just so impressed by the librarians. Each one stood up and said what was troubling them, just in complete candid, I mean, they were so candid, it was unbelievable, and what they expected to receive from participating in the study. It really was a wonderful experience. So this is a disturbing slide. This is the stigma and discrimination reported by those same 749 survivors. We see from the bottom up are the largest categories. Loss of income or job, 35%. Forced change of residence. These people had to leave their homes because they were forced out by their community or other reasons for fear of infection, 27%. And then I'll go all the way up to the top. 8% of these people who had been through such trauma lost their spouse because their spouse, so, you know, there are several of these people, they lost their job, they lost their home, they lost their spouse. Of 350 females of childbearing age, 12% are pregnant. We are following these 12% very closely because there is a very high mortality rate when it comes to the pregnancies, both from the mother's perspective and the child's. I only know of one child in Liberia right now, one infant surviving Ebola through pregnancy, through a pregnant Ebola survivor. We need to understand that. We need to understand why the infants are not surviving. I do know of two in Guinea. I just got a message today. The mother unfortunately did pass away when she gave birth to the baby. The infant is on the treatment study, as well as there is also a sibling of that infant on the treatment study. They are both doing well, and fingers crossed they will continue to do well. But it is the exception. So we do need to understand, we need to do this testing. We're going to test the breast milk, the cord blood, and the placenta to try and understand and mitigate these issues. This is just a slide to show. So our Liberian colleagues did just a informative interview session with 50 Liberian women ranged in age from 16 to 40. The majority were under 30 years old, and they expressed three major fears. One, that they will not have a normal pregnancy and delivery, that their children will not be normal. Nobody knows the long-term effects on children born from pregnant survivors, and whether or not they will have a greater chance of maternal mortality, which, and in fact, we know is actually true. So as I said here, pregnant women have a higher mortality from Ebola than those who were not pregnant, that is known. And those that survive were likely to miscarry or experience a stillbirth. The long term of EBD is not known on reproductive health, and we really need to understand that as well. Just to reiterate, childbirth has been recognized as a potential source of Ebola transmission to newborns. And to date, antenatal complications of births have just not been discussed much. It hasn't been out there as much as I would like to see it out there. There have been few reports of pregnancy outcomes from past Ebola outbreaks. So we haven't learned much from those, which I think is a shame. Let's change that. Sorry, this is one I went over earlier. So in summary, and I just got the 1 minute sign, so this is like right on, yay. Clinical research, we have to embed it in the initial outbreak response. We can't wait 10 months. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't work. This is something that's sort of new, these outbreaks. I mean, they're not new, but when you come to, we're going to have more of them, more of things like Ebola. These Ebola can happen from things like deforestation, population growth. We know these things are going to happen. We know that there's going to be a transmission of zoonotic diseases. We know this now. We have to be prepared. We have to be resourced. We have to be coordinated across the governments, NGOs, and industry. We spent a lot of time trying to figure out who was going to do what and how would we do it. And, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about those things. And it's actually kind of annoying to me. You know, we needed to have been in there ready to do something. There should be a plan to understand who does what, when, and where. It needs to be adequately planned, research, response, tools, templates prepared in advance and ready for use. So I'll be quiet here and be very interested in listening to Dr. Johnson, and I believe we'll be taking questions after the speakers. Thank you.